All right, let's open our Bibles to Exodus 25. That'll be our first reading in just a moment. But before we go to Exodus, let's do our three memory passages. Exodus 13:3, and Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place." Then Exodus 19:5, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine." And finally, the one that we're coming to this now, "Then the cloud covered the tabernacle of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." And it's one of those I realized today that on this last lesson, I left off the actual reference, chapter 40, verse 34. When you come to the story of the tabernacle, this is one of the harder lessons, I think, sometimes for us to understand. It's certainly one of the harder ones for me to teach. There are several things in it. As far as the reading of it, think about chapters 25 through 31. You get a lot of the details. Then you interrupt it for the chapters for the golden calf. Then you return to the tabernacle, and sometimes as it talks about the building of it and the preparation, it can seem kind of repetitious. As, you know, he gave the instructions in 25 through 31, then it seems like he's repeating it. We come to Leviticus and Numbers, and I'm trying not to get too much into those in this. You're going to find some more details about it. And when we try to get in our heads an exact picture of it, you know, I look through a lot of images trying to find something. You know, here's one representation of it. You will find that they all look a little bit different. You will find some that show a ridged, you know, an A-frame type tent over it, and I'll talk about that probably Sunday. Others have the flat. We don't know exactly. In Hebrews, the 9th chapter, and which is one of the readings that I included, and I hope everybody read through Hebrews 9. I could have added some other passages from Hebrews. But he's talking about the tabernacle and the items in it. And in verse 5, the statement is made, "Of these things we cannot now speak in detail." The Ark of the Covenant had been lost, and that tabernacle, of course, had been destroyed. You know, there are things about it we just don't know. Moses was shown a pattern. He wasn't just given the directions that we read. He was shown. And so, you know, what he was shown helped him, of course, to... Y'all, excuse me. Yeah, make sure that's not on ring. I don't want to pull up. Well, I'm not going to call Mike's name. Let my phone go off in class. You know, it's just hard to know exactly what it looked like. But having said that, if we don't grasp certain things about the tabernacle, we really miss a lot of the big picture of the Bible. And I confess to you, I did for many years. You know, this story is so important to the Bible picture. What you see in the tabernacle is a partial restoration of what we lost back in Genesis. In Genesis, God and man are together in the garden. It speaks of God. They heard the sound of God walking in the garden, and he spoke with them. He expels them from that. And what does God put to keep them from going back into the garden? The cherubim with the flaming sword. We go from Genesis 3 to Exodus before we read of cherubim again. You know, we've seen man lost that fellowship with God. But here, the point of the tabernacle is at least a partial restoration of this. Look at Exodus 25 and verse 8. And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. The point of the tabernacle was not merely a place of they're able to worship. It is a place of God dwelling. Look also in verse 21 of the 25th chapter. He said in verse 21, you shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark. And in the ark you shall put the testimony that I will give you. And there I will meet with you. And I will speak with you from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim which are on the ark of the testimony. God calls this, and sometimes the expression will be used, tabernacle of meeting. And he says, I will meet with you there at the mercy seat. In chapter 29, and I think I read this passage a week or so ago, but verses 45 and 46 are so critical to understanding the story. And this is still in this context of building the tabernacle. And he said, I will dwell among the children of Israel and will be their God. And they shall know that I am the Lord their God who brought them up out of the land of Egypt that I may dwell among them. I am the Lord their God. If you had asked me 25 years ago why God brought Israel out of Egypt, I would have probably answered it basically simply to fulfill the promise to Abraham that he was going to make of them a great nation and, you know, give them the Ten Commandments, lead them to the land of Canaan. And that's all part of it. But here he said, I brought you out of Egypt to dwell among you. In the tabernacle is God's dwelling. You think about how when he builds the temple to replace the tabernacle, Solomon does, God's glory filled that. And then you have Ezekiel. Ezekiel makes the point in Ezekiel 8 through 11 that God vacated the temple. That God says, I won't dwell among you right now. When Jesus comes to earth, in John, the first chapter, John says the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And the word dwelt there is literally tabernacled among us. That John chose a word that, I mean, dwelt is great. But I think he really even wanted to make the connections even tighter. That God, he put his tabernacle in the midst of men again. He put it there in the form of Jesus. In the New Testament, Christians, both the individual body, 1 Corinthians 6:19, your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. You know, Ephesians 2, other passages, he speaks of the church as the temple. And you take note of every time temple is used in the New Testament of the Christian or the church, it speaks of God dwelling among us. And then, of course, heaven is ultimately the final, complete fellowship with God. When we're looking at the tabernacle, we're seeing a step made toward our being reunited with God in a perfect and complete sense. And so, you know, don't miss that. But don't miss something else. And I've said a lot about this, but I want to remind you. Chapters 25 through 31 take place with Moses up on Mount Sinai. God is giving them instructions on how to build this tabernacle so he can be among them. And as that is drawing to a conclusion, they become disgruntled and they decide to build an idol to dwell among them. You know, don't miss that here is the Lord of heaven and earth giving instructions for how he can come down and dwell among them. And while he's doing that, they settle for an inanimate object, a calf. And so don't lose that. Well, let's look at chapters 25. We're not going to take these at all verse by verse. I'll kind of summarize some things. But where do the materials come from for the tabernacle? Free will offerings. The people are asked to give willingly. And he asked them, he said, if you are of a willing heart, take from them gold, silver, bronze, blue, purple, scarlet thread, fine linen, goat's hair, ram skin dyed red, some will say tanned, badger skins, acacia wood, oil, spices, and he goes on and on. Well, where did a bunch of escaped slaves get all these treasures? They plundered the Egyptians. Don't forget chapter 12, 35 and 36. God told them that you're to go and you're to ask for these things. And it said the Egyptians gave. They deserved some payment for their years of service. But God knew what was going to be built in the wilderness, what they were going to build. And I'm going to kind of jump ahead a little bit. The golden calf is a terrible failure on their part. But this part about the giving willingly, when it comes to that, that's one time they actually do quite well in that. They gave very generously. But number four, he said, you be careful to build it according to what? The pattern. Is that not the whole Bible? You do it according to the pattern. Not always shown you in the mountain. Abel didn't offer the sacrifice. Cain offered did not offer according to the pattern. Abel did. Noah, you built it the way I said. But look at verses 8 and 9 again, chapter 25. Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them according to all that I show you. That is the pattern of the tabernacle, the pattern of all its furnishings. Just so you shall make it. If God was going to dwell in this place, it had to be built according to God's pattern. You move forward to today. We are God's temple. My body, your body, temple of God's Spirit. We as a body, a collective, are God's temple. You think God's any less concerned today about it being built according to the pattern? That if we're going to be His temple, we better be built according to the pattern and apply that both individually and collectively. Whatever He shows for His church today that He's going to dwell among, we better follow that pattern. In our lives, we better follow that pattern. Look over to Hebrews 9 for a moment before we begin to kind of break down the tabernacle. I'm looking at verse 23. Therefore, it was necessary that the copies of the things in the heavens should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ has not entered the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. He's entered into the true holy place. We talk about types and shadows. There are things about the tabernacle that foreshadow the church. As I said, we today are his temple. But that's not the main point. The main point of the tabernacle was it was showing them access to God. Access to God through atonement, through washing. And that's going to be us. You know, in the 10th chapter of Hebrews, what does he tell us to do? Verse 19. To have boldness, have confidence to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he consecrated for us through the veil that is his flesh. We're going to be looking in the next lesson or so at the veil that separated man from God. And that talk about the restrictions on them. And then look at what we have today as we have this entrance being granted unto us. The tabernacle. I just remember being struck the first time as an adult that I actually started thinking about how small it was. It's only about 15 feet wide, which, you know, the front of this right here is a little more than that, probably close to 18. It wasn't quite as wide as, and I'm talking about the square part right here. It would have gone back to about the second row, about where Cody's sitting. You know, that's how long it was. It was a very small thing. Now, the court around it was a good bit bigger, 150 feet by 75 feet. That's still not that big. Now, it was small, but it was kind of elaborate, wasn't it? The gold and the silver that went into it was just amazing. Okay. Any thoughts or comments on the big picture of this? I don't want to trip and fall. Okay, let's look at the pieces of furniture. And I realized today, it hit me first time. Of course, this is the first time I've looked at the question since I typed them. I left off altar of incense. So in the new revised questions, under number 5, there is a letter D that says altar of incense, and then altar burnt offerings, and laver drops down a little bit. But the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Testimony, that's the first piece. Look at chapter 25 in verse 10, he begins the description. What's it made out of? Made out of acacia wood, covered in what? Gold. Several of the pieces are made out of this acacia wood. And now the top is a different story. We'll talk about that in a moment. But several of them made of acacia wood, covered in gold. I brought my tape measure in so y'all could see. It's about, this is it. It's about 45 inches long, by 27 wide, 27 high. It was short. It didn't stand up very tall. But when you think of Ark of the Covenant, I want you to think in terms, it was two very distinct pieces. And I'm going to get behind here. The Ark, the box. It contained the covenant. It's called the Ark of the Covenant, sometimes Ark of the Testimony, because the tablets of stone were put in that. That contained the Ten Commandments, the basis of the covenant. It had in it a pot of manna. It had in it Aaron's rod. That would be added later on, number 16. This box is forever the testimony that God has entered into a covenant with them. That they have agreed to be a people who will worship only Him. A people who will keep the Sabbath. A people who will be faithful to their wives, who won't steal, and the various things, and then all the laws that developed out of it. But the lid, what was the lid made of? It was solid gold, yeah. Meaning it would have been quite heavy. You know, it was shaped out of pure gold, and it had two what on it? Two cherubim. Remember, cherubim is plural. The singular is cherub. You can say cherubs or you can say cherubim. Either way. And I want to talk about them in just a moment. But they came up and their wings spread over it. This is the place of atonement. We'll be studying later on. And we come in our next quarter in Leviticus. We will spend a full lesson on the Day of Atonement. Yom Kippur is it called today. This is where the blood was placed every year to bring about forgiveness. This Ark of the Covenant, the box itself, symbolizes, I will be your God, you will be my people. The seat of atonement, the mercy seat, that is where it symbolized the only way a man can come to God. The only way a man can approach the holy God is by his sins being forgiven. And that's what the lid of this is about. You know, if you think about the Ten Commandments are in the box, link that to what we studied not that long ago in Romans. Paul said in Romans 7, I would not have known sin except what? The law had said, thou shalt not covet. That's what's in the box. Inside the Ark of the Covenant are laws that make man realize he's not holy. He has fallen short. The lid, the place of atonement, is where the blood is brought. The blood that would bring it where man can be with God. Now, we said there are cherubim on this. We've already talked about the first time cherubim are mentioned is Genesis 3. And think about cherubim in Genesis 3 are keeping men away from God. Cherubim are closely associated here with the tabernacle. They're on the mercy seat. They're going to be interwoven into the curtains of the tabernacle, into the veil. The cherubim are a little more welcoming, and yet the whole ark of the whole tabernacle is, I'll be in your midst, and you can be a little closer to me, but who could go into the tabernacle? Just the priest and the Levites. Into the most holy place, God is said to dwell among the cherubim, above the cherubim. This is God's throne, as it were, in Israel. Who could go in there? The high priest, and that only how often? Once a year. During the wilderness years, there were some exceptions in that when they had to move, they had to pack it up and go. But we'll talk about this later. The priest would take the veil down and walk straight forward and drop it over the Ark of the Covenant without even looking upon it. There's still a little bit of a keep your distance. What exactly did cherubim look like? Now, that was one of the things interesting when I was looking at different images of the Ark of the Covenant, how people drew the cherubim. Ezekiel talks about cherubim with four faces and four wings. Did these have four faces and four wings? It doesn't. All the words point more to just two wings, but I don't know. You know, there's a lot. Cherubim are some type of heavenly creatures that were special to God. And so this, I don't think it's any coincidence. This is the piece he starts with. With this one. Yes, sir. When they appeared, they looked like men, didn't they? That's right. How do people use the word, you know, little cherubs today? And this little fat, naked babies, you know, that have cute little wings coming out of them. The cherubim of the Bible were not cute little naked babies, I can tell you that. In fact, most time when an angel came, you know, our heavenly creature, it frightened. Look, the next place, the table of showbread, and we'll talk about all these, where they fit into the tabernacle later. It's a little, just so you have an idea. I mean, this is a huge table, right? It's about 36 inches, again. I mean, it's a little shorter than the Ark of the Covenant. What is it? It was only 18 inches wide. And one of the parts that's kind of fascinating to me, it's only 27 inches tall. You know, that's kind of, it was short. But what's it made out of? Acacia wood overlaid with gold. Some of the translations call this the bread of the presence instead of showbread. In fact, that may be a better rendering. The Ark of the Covenant, and especially the mercy seat, more is said about it. What does all of this symbolize? Well, let me just say this. They were going to put 12 loaves of bread on it. This drawing depicts it as two stacks of six. What the Bible says is two rows of six. It could be this way. It could have been laid out differently. But based on the size of the loaves, you get into it, tells the amount of flour that had to go into it and the size of the table. It would have been tough to have laid them out 12 in a row, you know, like that. So this is probably the way it was. It mentions gold pitchers and utensils that you may be able to see up there. What was done with them, we're never told. What I believe the bread of the presence symbolized is exactly what was done in Exodus 24. That God invited the people into his presence to eat. And God says, the table is always spread before me. I'm always there with you. You know, they didn't go through any kind of pretense like in some pagan temple where the priest tried at night to slip the bread out and act like, oh, our God came in and ate it while it was dark. No. It was all symbolic, and at the end of the week, the priest would take the loaves and they would eat those 12 loaves and replace it with 12 fresh ones. But it symbolized the covenant meal continues there. And then you've got the lampstand. And it has how many branches? Well, there's seven lamps on it. It's a seven-branch lampstand. What is it? I don't know the significance. It's never explained to us. But how often in the Bible is God pictured as light? I mean, what? It's a tent with all these curtains. You need some light. You got to have some light. But God is light. One of the things that's made very clear, chapter 27, I want you to take note of something. Verse 20. And you shall command the children of Israel that they bring the pure oil of pressed olives for the light, to cause the lamp to burn continually. In the tabernacle of meeting, outside the veil which is before the testimony, Aaron and his sons shall tend it from evening until morning before the Lord. It shall be a statute forever to their generations on behalf of the children of Israel. All night long, the lights are on in God's house. You know, I can't tell you that I know this with certainty. But what do we think? We drive by a house and we see the lights are on. We think somebody's home. People go on vacation. Sometimes they leave lights on because they want somebody to think they're at home. God was there. He was at home. He was there in it. Interestingly, I hope you can see this. I drew you an arrow for it. This is the Arch of Titus in Rome. This is when they looted the temple in AD 70, and it shows them carrying off a seven-branched lampstand. Now, this would not have been the one in the tabernacle, but based on that carving in Rome, most drawings of the lampstand are taken from that, because we don't know what it would have looked like otherwise. It was elaborate, let me tell you. It had all these carvings of knobs and flowers and, you know, it was very elaborate. And the combination of the lamp and its snuffers and all the various little utensils was a talent of gold. A talent of gold, you can probably say somewhere around 75 pounds. You know, the equipment used for it, it was not a little bitty lampstand or candlestick. It was big. Then there's the altar of incense. Now, this is the one that's kind of, to me, striking as far as its size. 18 inches square and only, 27 tall, was that what it was? I have to look back at my notes. 36, it was a little taller than that. It stood up like that. The altar of incense is going to be placed right outside the veil of the temple, the veil for the most holy place. I'm saving the curtains and all that for Sunday, but just to jump ahead, do you remember how tall the tabernacle was? 10 cubits, which would be about 15 feet. You know, a little higher than my hand. You know, it was 15 feet. The veil was approximately 7.5 feet, meaning it only went up about halfway. The altar of incense was put right outside that veil. And the incense is placed on it every day. They put the coals and the incense. And the idea was the smoke of the incense goes over the veil into where God dwells. Revelation 5:8 talks about the incense being the prayers of the saints. That's a, you know, New Testament reference. But I think that's the picture. Hebrews, the 9th chapter, he says of the altar of incense that it belonged to the most holy place. And there are those that think the Hebrew writer got confused because, no, it was outside the veil. Yes, it was outside the veil so that the priest could go every day to it. But it belonged to to the most holy place. You know, the altar of incense was their daily petition to God. It represented that. Quick New Testament reference. Where was Zacharias when the angel appeared to him? He was in the temple burning incense. It was his day to go to the altar of incense in the temple. Then there's the altar of burnt offerings. It was 7.5 feet wide. It was wood overlaid with bronze this time. Now, again, the exact picture of it, we don't know. But this altar, how can we approach God? Well, Hebrews 9:22, without shedding of blood, there's no remission. You know, the approach to God. God is dwelling among an unholy people. Any different than today? There had to be the sacrifice. There had to be the offering. And then, of course, there was the bronze laver. And I gave you two pictures this time. We're not given any detail other than it was bronze, and it said the priests were to wash their hands and feet in it. Some think that there were, and that neither one of these show it, some think there were spigots in it, taps that you could let water out. Others think it was kind of a double-layered laver. If it was like this, then you had to reach up and get the water to splash on your feet. With this, you could stick them in. I don't know. You know, what I understand, what I know is all of this, it was kind of, we might say, the ABCs of approaching God. It was the rudimentary facts. You don't come to God when you're not clean. God wasn't really concerned about dirt that might be on their hands. But it was a teaching tool that those that are going to approach Him have to be washed. They have to be clean. Those who would be holy, there have to be sacrifices offered. You know, now, when those things happen, you know what God's willing to do? He's willing to dwell with you. He is willing to have His dinner, as it were, with you, to leave the light on. These things are symbols of what God has taken a step forward today and an even greater step that we can look forward to one day in heaven when we'll no longer need the laver. We'll no longer need the altar of burnt offerings. We'll no longer need the altar of incense, because we will be there with Him and we can share in that fellowship. Now, they knew I was going to do it. First Sunday, I want you to study over the curtains. We're going to talk about them a little bit, the priestly garments, and then we're going to talk about the layout of the tabernacle and such for Sunday.